broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, guys. How are you going? There's a little bit of a squeal there amongst the group.
That's it. Thank God it's Friday.
We're just so happy to be here. Yeah.
Yes.
Good morning.
Last day of July, guys.
Oh, wow. He's two.
Oh, yep.
There you go.
Yep. I know it feels like Groundhog Day and heading into the probably one of the I hate to say it for you guys, but the coldest and rainiest kind of a month, isn't it, August?
Thanks, Steph.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. We got the best days ahead, huh?
Yeah. I was actually just thinking it was still April, and I was wondering why it was so cold.
Well, it won't matter because we're not allowed outside anyway.
That's exactly right. Just crank the heater up and you'll be right. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for our listeners, I've got to let you know that I've decided to stay in Queensland and not come home because I can actually work from home. So not to rub it in, but it's 22 degrees up here.
So, yeah, very jealous.
But I am inside like you guys.
Yeah, love you too, honey.
So should I ask you guys what the plans are for the weekend?
Oh. Might go mask shopping.
Oh, I don't know. Probably just a weekend of tapping away on the computer, trying to watch whatever sport I can find, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, isn't there like 30 days of AFL now? Did I hear that correctly, that it's just an ongoing football fest?
Yeah, it's every day for at least 20 days and then maybe longer.
Wow. Glad I'm not home.
It's the only thing that's a distraction at the moment, I think.
Absolutely.
A lot of us.
Yeah, it's a bit of a godsend to the country, actually, for a lot of people, and myself included, something to look forward to every day and check up on.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see whether Queensland has more of an adoption for AFL after this or whether it makes no impact at all.
Well, they've got two teams that are doing quite well too, so that might help.
Yeah.
Might help. Yeah. Very much a rugby state, though, so we'll see if it changes their perspective. Now, I think we might kick off today with Joel, and quite fitting, you're going to give us a bit of a temperature check on the market.
Yes, I am. It's been a little bit since I've run through just some basic statistics about where we are according to our macroeconomic model, where we look at a number of different areas of the financial system and the economy to get a gauge on whether or not we are in an environment that's conducive for stock price performance or not. We typically look at conditions that focus in on economic conditions around employment and interest rates and manufacturing activity. We also look at interest rates as well and whether or not the yield curve is positive or negative. And it's an environment where banks can lend and make money. We're also looking at measures of sentiment and whether or not investors are euphoric, are a bit cool or pessimistic. We also look for indications of financial stress. We're looking for technical market breadth and strength as well. And looking for valuations. And typically when we look at those conditions, we can get a good sense as to whether or not we should be aggressive in the market, whether or not we should be more defensive, and where pockets of strength might arise or pockets of weakness might be. So I thought today what I'd do is just run you through some of the things that we're seeing right now from a valuation perspective, where with the United States, the S&P 500, the S&P 500 at this point in time is currently trading on a historical price to earnings ratio of 23.13 times earnings and trading on a forward PE ratio of 23.68 times forecasted earnings for S&P 500 constituents. for the ASX, the Australian ASX 200 stock market, the largest 200 companies on our stock market, we're trading on a forward price to earnings ratio of 18.56%. 18.56 times versus a historical last year's trailing earnings of 16.85. So what that's a reflection of really is we're seeing that in the US, and we're seeing this in the US stock market, and there's a bit of a dichotomy here. The Australian stock market is trading on a higher price to earnings ratio, than what it was 12 months ago, but it's still some 20% away or 18% away from its all-time highs where it was at in February. Now, that's clearly a sign that right now the earnings recovery in Australia is not expected to be as robust as what we're seeing in the United States over the next 12 months. And that's clearly a sign that with the S&P only a few percentage points away from their all-time high, but yet it's consistent with where its PE was 12 months ago, we're seeing that the analysts are expecting a stronger recovery in earnings in the S&P 500 companies than what they are expecting in the Australian ASX 200 companies. Albeit, though, that valuations on a forward basis and on a historical basis for the S&P 500 are actually at quite a high level. So even though we're expecting a stronger earnings profile in the US, investors at this point in time have been quite optimistic with pushing those prices up. And I think that that's a sign. Right now we're seeing both indexes trading at price to earnings multiples that would historically be considered quite high. And that's probably a sign of the fact that we've got interest rates at very low levels. Typically you see an inverse relationship with price to earnings ratios and interest rates. When interest rates are low, you tend to see price to earnings ratios high. And when you see interest rates high, you tend to see price to earnings ratios quite low. So in this environment, where you would generally expect to see, you know, most developed markets trading on a price-to-earnings ratio of somewhere between sort of 14 to 16 times, in an environment where we've got the S&P ASX 200 on 18.5 times and the S&P 500 on 23.6 times, you'd probably have to say that the S&P 500 is quite fully valued right now, and you would say that the ASX 200 is probably a little bit is probably more fairly valued, but what you tend to also find is that PE ratios will tend to be higher in those environments where earnings growth is expected to be higher. So, in an environment where the US is opening up much quicker, interest rates are low. Yes, the PE is higher than historical norms. But I would say that it's probably a little bit over fair value at this point in time. The ASX 200 is probably more likely to be in a fair value range. So it doesn't provide too much of a concern at this point in time with regards to valuations, because we also need to take into account the fact of what the earnings is actually doing. And we've seen through this particular downturn and this particular recession that price to earnings ratios for major developed economies can actually look overvalued in the early phases of or in the middle phases of a recession, because earnings fall off a cliff. And so the earnings part in the price to earnings ratio can actually be suppressed. So, and that has typically been a sign of when to buy, when price to earnings ratios in a cyclical earnings trough or a secular earnings trough are at an all-time low, because it's a sign that that earnings are suppressed, not the P is suppressed, and that with earnings recovering, depending on the strength of that recovery in earnings, you could generally see that the price-to-earnings ratios can actually come down over this period of time and stock prices can still go higher.
So is that because the earnings part of the equation is typically looking back over the last year or looking forward over the next 1 year, which is just not long enough time period?
Correct. That's exactly right. So we're in this environment. Like, we can go back to the global financial crisis, and the price to earnings ratio reached an all time high at the lows of the GFC, because no company in the US at the worst of the GFC was actually making a profit. In fact, in the fourth, I think it was the fourth quarter of 2008, the S&P registered its first negative quarter of earnings ever recorded.
Ever.
ever, yeah, in the fourth quarter of 2008, when the US was right at the depths of their recession and the whole financial system was at its worst. Because earnings were negative, the S&P 500 traded on its highest price to earnings ratio ever. It was like a multiple of thousands and thousands.
Yeah, right.
So you got to be a little bit careful about how you interpret these price to earnings ratios. And right now, I would say that you probably got more of a yellow rather than a red flashing sign when it comes down to valuation. But then if we have a look through valuation, we have a look at some of the other important economic indicators, we need to be looking at what the trend is. Okay, it's not what the actual aggregate value or what the actual value is today. We need to be looking at what the trend and what the direction of these numbers are suggesting to us. So when we have a look at financial stress in the financial stress, we can see that financial stress in regards to the high yield spread. So this is the difference between what high grade borrowers versus the treasury market can borrow. So the difference between those interest rates. We saw a huge spike into March of this year, but it's come and it's collapsed. So the percentage of spread was, prior to the crisis, was trading around about 3.5%. It exploded to a widening of around about 11%. And now it's come back to a level of around about 5.3%. So that spread is collapsing and it's coming back in, and that's a sign that that the level of return that that lenders are requiring for lower grade debt is starting to come back in, and the premium on that lower grade debt is not as much as what it was when all fear and panic was around. We also see that the Office of Financial Research, they put out a financial stress index, and their financial stress index, which was sitting at around sort of negative 4.5%, which is actually good. They're benign financial stress conditions. Prior to the crisis, it peaked at a positive 10. And now it's come back into a negative 2.5. So at negative 2.5, that's an indication that there really isn't any financial stress in the financial system, and that most corporations, most institutions, most governments, and most households are still being able to meet their loan repayments, and are not experiencing levels of financial stress that could potentially undermine the stability of the financial system at this point in time. So at this point in time, financial stress levels would be flashing a green sign under our economic model. When we have a look at the interest rate yield curve, this is the difference between what short-term loans are versus longer-term loans. So when you think about how a bank makes money, they borrow from us as depositors, lend to us as longer-term mortgage borrowers, and the way that they make money is by paying us a smaller amount of interest than what they're collecting from us on the longer-term mortgages that they lend to us. The yield curve in the United States, which is the most important indicator, which is when we typically look at the 2-year versus the 10-year Treasury, U.S. Treasury bond yield, which is the benchmarks for most of the world's interest rate settings, that is now at a positive spread of 0.45%. It did dip late into 2019 as a small short-term inversion, but it reversed very quickly. That inversion has now been reversed, and we're seeing the yield curve actually start to steepen, which is a green sign for financial markets. It's the same can be said in the Australian economy. We're seeing a nice positive steep yield curve in the Australian bond market, which indicates that banks can still make money in this environment. So interest rate conditions are quite conducive for banks to be able to continue to lend and make profitable loans, albeit they've got credit risk in this environment during a recession. Looking at some of the economic conditions, we look at the U.S. Retail sales. Retail sales in the U.S. have jumped dramatically in the last month, up 17.7% in June. We're waiting for the July numbers will come out sometime in the next couple of weeks. From an all-time low of 14.7% fall in April. Look at Australian retail sales, they're on the improve. We saw a big 16.9% increase in June over the month of May. Now, we don't yet have the full impact of what the Victorian lockdown might have on retail sales in the July month, but certainly there was a strong indication of recovery in June as most of Australia started to open up. Retail sales in China are positive. They saw a big decline in the early part of this year, but essentially it's been a huge recovery ever since then, and has been consistently positive at a sort of around that 0.8 to 0.9 of a percent month on month change. Because we've got to remember, China really didn't shut down. There was only one region of China that actually shut down, and that was the Wuhan province. Most of China still remained open during the pandemic. We have a look at European retail sales. They've jumped by 17.8% in June over the month of May. So we're seeing the European retail sales region start to improve. UK, it's a similar story with a 12% month-on-month increase. Japan has also seen a month-on-month increase in retail sales, albeit quite anemic compared to some of the others, with just a 2.1% increase. So consumers are back.
I wanted to ask you though, I mean, why do you think that people, like consumers, are buying? Because I would be thinking the opposite in an environment like this. What do you think, that these numbers are real, or is it just that people haven't had the ability to go and shop for a while, and they're, you know, what do you think this is?
Well, I mean, look, the reality is that most global economies completely shut down during March and April. So so the rebound that we're seeing doesn't mean that we're back to the levels that we were prior to COVID. But what it means is that the recovery is underway.
Okay.
As economies are opening up, people will go out and spend more on the things that they couldn't spend on prior to, you know, March and April being shut down.
But do you think it's sort of smoke and mirrors at the moment, because people are going out and sort of buying, and then, you know, when realities strike, when people do start losing more jobs, or, you know, JobKeeper and JobSeeker actually cease, particularly in Australia, that we're actually going to see this reverse?
Well, I think one of the important things you've got to understand is that what happens in Australia really doesn't impact what happens in the rest of the world.
Yep.
The key indicator is what happens in the United States and in the bigger economies of Europe and Asia. We're pretty much just a drop in the ocean, Australia, in regards to our impact that we have on the global economy. And you've got to think, there's seven states and territories here in Australia, and six of them are fully functioning. Mm. It's only really Victoria that is dragging everything back. So, yes, Victoria's GDP represents about 25% of Australia's gross domestic product. But overall, the rest of Australia is opening up. Overall, the rest of Europe is opening up.
Yeah.
Overall, most of Asia is opening back up, and the US is opening back up, albeit for certain states where they've gone back into some form of lockdown, like California.
I will question that one though. Like, I mean, sitting in Queensland at the moment, certainly that New South Wales is going to have their border slammed shut. So the Queensland Premier is closing the border here on Saturday.
That's just to Sydney siders. That's not to all of New
correct.
South.
Correct. Yeah, but we've got Victoria locked out as well, and I'm starting to see them drop their hotel rates here, and the worry of no tourists coming through is a real impact to a state like Queensland.
Look, I agree with you, and this is where the conversation probably needs to be a little bit more around using a scalpel rather than the sledgehammer these days. You've got Western Australia that has got their borders closed to states that don't have any coronavirus cases, like the Northern Territory or Tasmania. Well, that doesn't seem to make too much sense to me. South Australia has basically zero cases of coronavirus, yet Western Australia won't open their borders. So you've got these artificial barriers that are being put in place, that even though Victoria has its issues, and there's perhaps a couple of issues in Sydney area, we probably need to become a little bit more refined with how we approach managing, the spread of coronavirus now, and how we manage travel between the various states, so that commerce can start to free up and people can start to travel around this federation that we actually have.
But what's your take on, the way that Europe or America has performed throughout this? I mean, they've had you know, hundreds of thousands more deaths than we have. Do you think they've done a better job of keeping sort of borders open, or, you know, going too soon? I mean, what's your thoughts?
Well, clearly not, right? I mean, they've had significantly worse outbreaks than what we've experienced here in Australia. But I think their way of thinking is, well, we've got to get on with life, and we've got to get on with life in a cautious approach. But yeah, certainly, we were looking through what travel was allowed in many parts of Europe and other parts around, you know, the Americas and even the Caribbean, and most of those countries are opening up their borders to tourists and for inbound tourism and travel and cross-border travel between various countries, where we haven't even got to the point where we're opening our borders to just our own citizens here in Australia. So, you know, at some point in time, we're going to have to either, I mean, with what we're seeing in Victoria right now, it's hard to see with the leadership that we have in place that they're going to adopt the approach that most Europeans and most American states are taking. That, you know, in that, okay, hey, you know, we've got it, we need to be careful, but we've got to open the economy back up. We seem to be thinking a little bit differently here in this country, perhaps because we didn't have it so bad in the first wave. And we're trying to protect that. So, look, whether it's the right decision or the wrong decision, there's certainly going to be some serious economic consequences as a result of that. I have my opinions, but everyone else has their opinions, and, you know, what ends up being the right way. But the reality is I don't have any influence over this, so I have to adapt to this environment. We have to sort of still try and make money in an environment that that we have no control over. So therefore, this is why it's important to start looking at what the economic numbers are doing, and they should be leading us, and looking at our macroeconomic model. So coming back to that, you know, we've seen retail sales is improving. We're also seeing consumer confidence improving in most areas around the world, apart from Australia. We've taken a bit of a dip back. Europe and the UK, they've had negative consumer confidence for quite some time, but that's largely as a result of issues around their economy, lasting back to the GFC, and for the UK lasting back to Brexit. But we have started to see consumer confidence improve, albeit still be negative. We're seeing an improvement in Japan's consumer confidence by quite a reasonable jump, going from sort of the low 20s to now approaching the high 20s. We're seeing unemployment improve in the United States. It's coming down from a peak of 14.7 down to 11.1% in June. We're seeing China's unemployment rate has come down from a peak of 6.3 down to 5.9. So there's improvement here. Once again, don't think about the level. Think about the direction. We're seeing improvement in the UK unemployment rate. We're seeing improvement in economic conditions, so gross domestic product. We haven't yet got the data out for that, but we are seeing that manufacturing in many of the regions around the world is certainly improving. So if we have a look at some of the manufacturing indicators, the United States is registered 49.8 from a low of 35.2 when we look back to April. So we're seeing, although it's still in recession, it's almost on the verge. So 50 is the demarcation line between recession and growth in the manufacturing sector. The US has gone from a level of 36 or 37 in April to now be at 49.8, so it's on the verge of now going back into expansion. We're looking at the Australian manufacturing sector. Interestingly enough, we're now back in expansion as well. We got down to a low of 36, and now we're up at 51.5. So we're in expansion territory from a manufacturing perspective. China's the same. They're now at 51.2, back into expansion. The European region is improving from a depth of what was down at 33. Now that's back up around 47.4. So you're seeing these improvements, and I keep coming back. It's the same thing in the UK. Economic conditions are improving from the depths. So in this environment, and Japan as well. So, and Japan's just gone back into expansion. So in this environment where you're seeing, you know, a positive yield curve slope, where you're seeing, you know, financial stress come down, you're seeing improvements in economic activity around the globe. Yes, there's going to be some shocks and some bumps along the way. And yes, we're moving into what could potentially be, which is typically the seasonally weakest months of the year between August, September and October. Medium to longer term, the improvement is clear. We are seeing an improvement. We are seeing a rebound. And it's not a good idea to be sitting in cash and being too conservative in an environment where the economic recovery is starting to get underway. So all things being equal, while we may have a little bit of softness over the next few months as we sort of digest some of these recent gains and the recovery that we've seen in stocks around the world, I don't think you want to be too pessimistic. You need to be understanding where the general direction is, and the general direction across the globe, across the financial system, is that we're seeing improvement, and that means that you need to be thinking about being invested and continuing to look for opportunities right now.
Good to hear an optimistic outlook on the whole thing. So hopefully we are really heading in the right direction, and I hope that sort of remains that way going forward. So thank you for your update today. We're going to take our first quick break today, and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Hey, welcome back, guys. I'm just going to actually throw out a bit of a poll here. I'm just going to ask you guys, if our borders were to be opened in Australia at the moment, how likely would you guys be to actually take a trip overseas somewhere?
I'd go in a heartbeat.
Depending where. I'd be willing to, but I'd probably be a little bit critical or concerned about where.
Mm-hmm. I'd be very unlikely, not because of the destination, but because of the airplane ride.
Just that they haven't fired up the planes for a little while, or just
just the environment of being in close proximity to another person for so long.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I'm a bit of a fence sitter with the whole thing. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm a massive traveler, but that would even concern me a little bit to get on a plane and probably sit there in a closed in cabin for that amount of time. I'm kind of with you, Louis.
Yeah, that's my only thing. Otherwise, I'd be in New Zealand in a heartbeat.
Yeah,
we were looking at going there anyway before the outbreak came, so that'd be our plan.
It'd be interesting. Are they still talking about that New Zealand bubble, or is that just forget about it now that Victoria's gone into another lockdown?
I haven't heard about it in months, so yeah. I'm guessing that would be the case. I mean, I think from memory it was pretty clear that if there was boundaries internally within Australia, then they weren't going to open up the boundary between the two countries.
Yeah, it's going to be a wait and see, I think.
Yeah, and the initial borders went up pretty quick within Australia, which became the sticking points and the litmus test, and with the WA border being closed still. I think they were – I'm not sure they were the first, though. I think Tasmania was the first and South Australia followed quickly.
Yep.
And then WA followed suit a day or two later, again, from memory. But, yeah, that's the main thing with New Zealand.
Yeah. I'm sure Dan Andrews is kicking himself now saying he'd want to visit South Australia.
Yeah.
No one wants to visit Victoria.
He's having a great run, isn't he?
Yeah. I actually feel a bit sorry for him. It'd be a hard one to follow up with after what's happened. So
yeah, tough gig.
He looks pretty tired when you see him on TV nowadays.
Nah, fuck him. He's put us into lockdown. He can wear it.
Always good to get different perspectives, Joel.
Yeah, I think North Face are pulling back their sponsorship too. They're not happy with his performance. I think he's worn like that same socks. Jacket about 60 days straight, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think
well,
so.
You know what? He's just like everyone. He's got his Rona outfit, doesn't he?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, look, we're going to throw over to Brett now, and you're going to talk to us about some data changes in the property market.
Yeah, just touching on what's happening. It's a pretty slow burn in property, especially when you hear the data Joel talks about. It's a bit more dynamic across stock markets than the residential property market in Australia. Obviously, transactions are a lot higher in terms of value, and they're a lot slower to happen. So the data flow of trends and you know getting anything impactful from it is a little bit slower to really be able to interpret. Of the data we monitor, though, the pre-listing activity that talks to how many people are looking to come to market is pretty flat. It dropped only 0.5% last week. It's still down around 13% year on year, which from all, you know, the understanding we have of what's going on in the world, it makes perfect sense. New listings, though, people that have actually come to market is up just over 3% from last month. So there's still enough people around the country that believe now's a reasonable time to sell, and there's still plenty of transactions happening. Granted, they're at a lower volume than last year. Clearance rates are being dragged down by Melbourne. You know, Victoria's roughly 50% of the total auction market in Australia. And given the lockdown scenario, nearly 50% of scheduled auctions were withdrawn. So that has Melbourne's clearance rate under 50% at 46 and a bit, which brings the national average or the national clearance rate down to 54%, which is more on a buy side than a sell side. You know, 63% is considered equilibrium. So to see it at 54 means it's slightly below that. The one piece of data that I think is a bit of an outlier in our understanding of what you'd expect around the COVID-19 circumstances is in where financing is being allocated at the moment. It's understandable that there's a lot of people refinancing with interest rates being really low, but I picked up on one piece of data here that I thought was a little bit surprising. The amount of mortgagee in possession valuations being ordered is actually down over 27% for the year.
Wow. Okay.
So that no tells fault. Me if we look behind it, yeah, there's not a lot of foreclosures happening, to use an American term. But it tells me that both the mortgage deferrals that are in place and the JobKeeper are actually doing what they're sort of designed to do. And there aren't a lot of forced sales at the moment.
That's good news.
Yeah. Yeah, it is good news. Like I would have expected that maybe mortgagee in possession sort of scenarios would have been in line with where they've been over time, but for it to be down by nearly 30%, I thought was a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting stat.
Yeah, it is interesting. I wonder what it means for September when the rules around the loan deferrals get tightened up, and then beyond that as people who might be in financial stress but not making repayments right now get forced to make those repayments.
This is the potential unknown. Cliff. Yeah, that's right, Louis. And there's a potential cliff that's being referred to in a lot of the market commentary at the moment. Is we're heading towards it, we just don't know how big it'll be.
Yeah, and I think they will continue. It was certainly a cliff in September. Then they announced they extended it, but they'll tighten it and they'll continue to try and turn a cliff into a gentle slope.
Yeah.
Try and create a soft landing in the face of otherwise strength of a recovering economy would be their hope.
Yeah. Can I look? You know, in my experience, I've seen multiple potential cliffs over the last decade. I mean, coming out of the global financial crisis, every 12 months there seemed to be a potential cliff, and when we know about that cliff and when we start to and everyone's talking about it, almost always it's a non-event. because we adapt to it, we make plans for it.
We plan and prepare for it.
What creates the shock and the fear and the panic is when something comes and catches us by surprise, and we're not ready for it, we're not prepared for it, and there's all of this mass uncertainty around how to manage it. So my reading of this is that if I look at these types of cliffs that we're all talking about right now, more often than not, it's generally quite a benign experience.
Yeah, they'll fix it before it happens.
Well, the next bit of information that I wanted to share is actually leading to how that's really already happening. If we look at the biggest concern is that the values drop significantly. And if values drop, it's typically a market where it's driven by supply and demand. And the supply side is already reacting, as you'd expect, in anticipation of lower demand. So building approvals are down at an 8-year low. So they're at the lowest they've been since the GFC. So there's obviously a lot of participants in the property market that are seeing that, you know, the future isn't as rosy with demand. So they're withdrawing from the market and not wanting to bring as much new stock to the market. So dwelling approvals were down 5% last month. So this is the ABS's latest building approvals data. The interesting part of it, though, is there was a significant increase in the value of renovations being approved. So there's a lot more people now that, rather than selling their houses, are actually deciding, or even to develop new houses, are actually taking their existing houses and improving them.
Right.
Is that due to the money that they've been given?
The home builder grant.
The home builder grant, yeah.
I think it's a combination of two things. I think there's probably a lot of people thinking, well, you know, we're not really going to be able to, you know, we're not comfortable with trying to sell our house in the next 3 or 6 months or more, or maybe even a year. So if we're going to be here for a while, let's turn it into something we really enjoy, or let's make all those improvements we've been thinking about if we're not going to move. And a combination of, well, the incentive's there, so let's take an advantage of it.
Yeah. But, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Jeez, I wish I had shares in Bunnings.
Yeah, they'd be doing pretty well. And sausages are back.
I know, but it's only in some states. So.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. So, and only open for Karens to come and buy.
I actually feel really sorry for anyone with the name Karen. They've all been tough.
I know, they've been all bundled into that same basket.
Yeah.
One last thing to touch on, which I thought was an interesting note. St. George is going to waive their LMI charges for owner-occupier and first home loans up to a loan size of $1 million. Yeah, so they're going to allow people to go up to 85% without any LMI, or, well, they'll have LMI, but they'll probably only charge $1 for it rather than the typical amounts they would charge.
Do you think that's a risky proposition, Brett, or do you think that's a good thing?
Look, I think it's a good thing. Whether other lenders follow suit and it's just a marketing ploy to try and get marketing share, but at least there's someone out there if you know, you're wanting to enter the market now and you don't have as much of a deposit, but you know they do their assessment and believe you're a worthwhile candidate. I think it's good. It'll allow a few more people to potentially buy where they otherwise wouldn't.
Right. Interesting one.
Mm.
Well, thank you very much for that update. I think this is going to flow nicely into our next topic that Louis is going to come back with, but we're going to take another very short break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw over to Louis. And off the back of that LMI conversation with Brett, you're going to talk to us today about a friend's mortgage situation and what they should potentially do.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Steph. These friends are looking at moving house. They've already sold the house that they were in, so they're looking at what house they're going to have next. And it's a pretty common conundrum, I think, that every house buyer goes through. Should we get a big, beautiful house that we love to live in right now and we'll have a great lifestyle, or do we get a smaller house with a lower purchase price with a lower mortgage? And then we can maybe pay off that mortgage even sooner, which means that maybe in 10 years or 20 years' time, we can have an even nicer house, or have the same great house but have it debt-free or substantially reduced debt. So it's the age-old conundrum. Do we have what we want right now, or do we go through a period of sacrifice so that we can have what we want in future? In an easier way in future.
Yeah, well, I think for them it would have to depend on exactly the right area for them to be wanting to settle into, and knowing long term that that's going to be their absolute dream area if they really are going to take on that much more money for a mortgage.
Yeah, that's right. And the considerations that these guys are making is between a house that requires $1 million loan. Which for them is going to lead to a pretty high amount of mortgage repayment. Mm-hmm. And the alternative is to take a house that's going to result in $500,000 loan, which is obviously a lower repayment, half the amount, really, if you're just making the minimum repayments.
What stage of life are they at, Louis?
They're early stage. So wow. This is a pretty typical question that I've had from various people over my career, but typically younger people, so people in their 30s or early 40s who still have 20 years or more of working life ahead of them.
And a lot of it could be dictated a bit by family circumstances.
Just going to ask that.
With children and the like, because obviously whatever the housing demand or the needs are going to be dictated around their family
as much as anything. Right. Yeah. And sometimes the question comes from people who have already had kids. Sometimes the question comes from people who are newly married or a new couple buying their first home. And that's where the obvious thing to point out is, well, you've got this amount of income today, but you just told me that you're not thinking of having kids yet, but maybe in 3 years' time or 5 years' time you'll be having kids. What do you do then? If you go down to a one income household for a period of time, or a one and a half income household for a longer period of time, what are you going to do to service the loan there? In this particular case, not a consideration. Kids are already there, so the income they've got is the income they've got. Now, I've run some scenarios in the past, and the thing which I've looked at previously, and when I first ran this scenario, was before the global financial crisis, and interest rates were typically around 7.5%. And what I looked at is, if you take a mortgage under situation A, and you make, which is the higher amount of mortgage, mm-hmm. and you're making those repayments over the standard 30 years, what if you take a mortgage that is half the size but make the same amount of repayment as the full-size loan?
Yep.
And what I worked out was that instead of if you make the repayments, let's say you make the repayment of $1 million loan, but your actual loan size is only $500,000, you're going to pay off that loan in just under 10 years.
Okay. That's a great
idea. So $1 million loan at 7% interest rates, the minimum repayments are about $6,650 per month. Mm-hmm. If you put the same amount of repayments into a $500,000 loan, it's less than 10 years to pay off that loan.
Right, that's interesting.
So in theory, you could buy $500,000 home as your first home, pay that off in 10 years, then buy a $1 million home with a $500,000 loan, pay that off in another 10 years, and then buy a $1.5 million home and pay that off in 10 years.
Yeah, well, that's sort of interesting too. I mean, even thinking about the kids are already there. I don't know how old the kids are, but, I mean, down the track, you might not want to have this dream home that they think they do when kids actually end up deciding to leave and you've got this sort of massive family home left. So, you know, maybe they bank that money and go on a great holiday.
Yeah, well, maybe they do. And this is where it starts to get a bit beyond the realms of financial planning. I mean, in financial planning, we can do our best to crunch the numbers and outline the variables and the potential future options. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what do you want the bigger house for? And if you have to go for 20 years of your life when your family is at its largest, where you don't have the nice big house, well, then what's the whole point of it?
Yeah.
The point is probably that you've got the nice house in the nice location with the nice schools and the nice facilities when you're in your 30s, 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And then by the time you're in your 60s and the kids are not at home anymore, well then you don't need the same kind of dwelling to live in.
Such a hard one, isn't it, though? Because, I mean, the other thing that comes into it and would come into it for me anyway is having a life as well on top of that, and not feeling that you have to pay that mortgage off and be sort of strung out every month and not have a lifestyle. And you want to be able to do fun stuff with your kids and, you know, do take a family holiday and not feel like you're completely, you know, pressed every month to actually make those mortgage repayments. So it's that really, I think, comes down to personal preference. But I was going to ask you, Louis, with all the advice that you give to clients, have you noticed that people that come up with their sort of their dream idea or dream home do tend to change their perspective down the track? Or do you think most people have a goal, get to it and want to stay on that, and they don't sort of defer from what they initially set out to do? I mean, how many people change their mind?
It is. That's a really good question, Steph.
Mm.
And what I find is that for the most part, people don't change their habits and behaviours.
Right.
And the way we act in one area is pretty consistent with the way we act in another area. What okay. I mean by that is if you're a person who tends to think really strongly about one thing but then wake up the next day with a different opinion, then that's going to translate to other areas of your life.
Yeah.
So if you can't decide, I don't know, what kind of car you like to drive, if that's what's important to you, and you keep changing from one car to another car every year or two, you're just not happy with your possessions. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to be different whether you're talking about a pair of shoes or a house that you live in.
Well, maybe that's sort of an interesting point for them as well on how decisive these people are in their life.
Well, yeah. The thing is, I want to still be their financial planner, and how much do I point out about their personality in order to keep them as a client?
Absolutely.
So am I a financial planner or am I a life coach?
Both, I would say.
And it often does become a bit of both, and that's why your best financial planners have the relationship with you. They got to have a bit more of a sense than the cut and dry numbers, because so much of this comes down to personal preferences and balancing people's lives. That's what people are really looking for in a financial planner. Anyone can crunch the numbers. Well, not anyone. Anyone who's good with a spreadsheet can crunch the numbers. But the value of financial planning comes from translating numbers into real life outcomes, which then suit that person and allow that person to make the best informed decision for their life.
It's tough, isn't it, Louis, because there's so many variables. You've almost got, like, to bring it down to a science, build a matrix and put weighting on the important factors to try and end up, it's like a formula to try and get to a decision.
Yeah,
exactly. And to be able to do that requires a financial planner who is very logic-based and process-oriented and numbers-focused, but then your people with that skill set are probably not the same people with the skill set to communicate with emotional intelligence and to empathize with the client that they're sitting in front of. So again, just coming back to what you're looking for in a financial planner is those things, and trying to come back to a good decision for these clients, which one to have, whether it's the large home loan or the small home loan. But there's another consideration here, because it's one thing to have a mortgage that's paid off, but it's another thing to look at the end value of the property that you're actually living in.
Yeah.
So the other thing that occurred to me is if you buy the bigger house up front, well, then what is the value of that bigger house going to be compared to the value of the smaller house? And if real estate values double every 10 years, if you bought the $1 million house to start with versus the $500,000 house to start with, well, you got to look at that doubling effect and where that gets you.
Another important factor.
So it's another important factor. And again, when I was doing these calculations back in the mid-2000s, we had a very different interest rate market and a very different property market. Whereas today we've got low interest rates, but also potentially a lower rate of growth in the property market in the next 5 years than what we had through the early, mid and late 2000s.
Although I doubt
you'll
be selling anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, interest rates being lower at the moment actually means that the 10-year time period to pay off the smaller loan is actually longer.
Yeah.
So the concept then blows out to actually being more like 12 years to pay off the loan that's half the size, which means you couldn't pay off three of those loans in the time it takes to pay off the one large loan. It's more like 2.5. So the numbers don't quite apply in the same way. And there is one alternative which I think needs to be floated out there. The biggest difference between the two equations is firstly the amount of debt and secondly the amount of interest repayments. One is the income side and the other is the expense side. And if you're looking at having half the debt, then you're only looking to influence the expense side. What about an alternative where you keep the debt the same, $1 million of debt, but you influence the income side of things and also the capital value side of things? And that's where, instead of comparing a $1 million property purchase with $1 million loan versus a $500,000 property purchase with a $500,000 loan, my third scenario would be, why don't you look at a $500,000 home and a $500,000 investment property? That way, you've still got $1 million of real estate that will get the same capital growth over the long term. You've still got $1 million of debt, but you're now receiving rental income on a $500,000 property, which helps you to service that debt. So again, you got to crunch the numbers and you got to look at that as a viable alternative situation. And there's all sorts of new variables that are introduced, like tax deductions and depreciation impacts, the risk associated with having tenants and making sure you're buying quality piece of real estate, capital gains tax issues at the end of it. But you've got to look at that as a viable third option.
Yeah.
And again, just make the right decision for you, because you've got short-term consequences and long-term consequences, all kinds of variables are going to point towards the different right decision for one family versus another right decision for another family.
Yeah, and that's interesting, Louis, too, because the third scenario was something that I would never have thought of. So, it comes back to having a good financial advisor and getting all the facts and actually just sort of thinking outside the box, really, because that's not something that I would have even thought of, to be honest.
That's right. Yep. And so when I thought of this and put it forwards, the initial comment was, oh, look, we'll never actually be comfortable with having that kind of investment with tenants that are out of our control and there's too much that we can't influence. And I said, well, look, psychologically, if that's going to be your opinion, you're actually never going to be financially successful. If you can't take on the thought of relying on tenants to pay rent, you're also not going to be able to take on the reliance on share markets to generate returns. which means you're not going to have any investments in your life. And the same thing happens for super. You're never going to be engaged with your super because you've got this feeling of control that you can't let go of.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that go into choosing the right lifestyle, choosing the right assets, crunching your income and your expenses, but then also your personal profile as well.
Yeah. Have the friends made a decision yet, Louis?
No.
No? Interesting. I'll be keen to hear the follow-through of this on another podcast.
We'll have to revisit after.
Yeah.
We'll see what they say. And and they actually don't know that I'm talking about them on this podcast.
No one was named.
I'm pretty sure they're not listeners. but we'll see what happens.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, we might close out with our final segment of the day, which is You Can't Be Serious. And I know that you've all got one. I think, Joel, you wanted to start today?
Yes, Steph. Well, we all know that there's a lot of debate, particularly down here in Melbourne, around the usefulness of wearing a mask. Mask wearing has become quite an annoyance, to be honest with you, but we're all doing it. We're doing our part. In the United States, in fact, there's quite a lot of debate about mask wearing. So I thought I'd share this clip with you to show you how rife it actually is.
This morning, as COVID cases mount across the country, the mask debate is intensifying.
People are very passionate on both sides of the great mask debate.
The partisan mask debate is heating up.
Mask debate.
The president is trying to have us cover the mask debate.
CVS, Target, and Walgreens are getting in on the mask debate.
The mask debate now taking center stage at local restaurants.
It's 9 minutes after six now, and there's new video of a raging mask debate. The mask debate in Georgia is getting ugly. The great mask debate in West Virginia might soon be coming to an end.
This mask debate is...
Wow,
self-indulgent. What a giant bunch of masturbators.
I think you get the message.
Yeah. I actually sent that to a friend of mine this morning, and she didn't get it for the first couple of minutes, and then she had to replay it, and I thought, my God, like, I mean, maybe it's my terrible mind, but I didn't pick up on that pretty quick.
Yeah, as soon as I heard it the first time, I go, is that what
here
it's
we
about?
Go.
Yeah.
If you actually watch it too, there's a priest in there, and I think there was one line on the priest, wasn't there, Joel, saying that he was involved in his own mass debate. So.
I would like to see the live news stream of a panel debate. For the a great panel mask debation.
That's a really good one.
I'll pick up another one. A couple ones actually. Some cases to contrast. A lottery winner in the USA won a $22 million Powerball, but actually, him and his friend, his best friend of many years. Made a handshake agreement back in 1992 that if one of them won the lotto, they would share it with the other one.
Oh, ouch.
So what's this guy done? Well, he's called his mate and he's told him he's won the Powerball, and now they're both retired. They both took home $6 million after U.S. taxes were paid.
Wow.
They're both retired. Their families will still take holidays together and enjoy a wonderful life in retirement.
Oh, well, that's very nice.
That's a great story.
That's heartwarming, isn't it? All just on a gentleman's handshake with his best mate. Another case of the lotto comes out of the Northern Territory, where a woman claims to have won $126 million on the Powerball out of there. But she reckons she won. The lotto denied her claim and it went to court because it turned out she actually put the bet on the wrong lottery.
Oh.
So she put the numbers down on a competition using the online booking. And her numbers came up, and then she didn't get anything from it.
Oh, that
is. You think that You think that until it goes to court. And there's this big debate about, you know, whether one contest looks the same or different to the other. Do you actually know what you're buying? But the deciding factor came down to the time that she bought the ticket was actually 2 hours after the numbers had been drawn. Come on!
Can't
be serious.
You can't be serious.
I think that's a pretty good try.
Worth a shot.
Absolutely. Brett, what do you got for us?
Look, I'm going to talk about breakup spite and a Cairns man who's been quite creative with his vengeance here. So he's gone around and plastered posters around town with his ex-girlfriend's phone number and a big poster saying anyone that calls this number with their best Chewbacca impression will win $100. And she was getting calls at all hours of the day and night.
I love that. It's hilarious.
But she's a good sport. She actually said, look, if there's one out there that can do it very close to the real Chewbacca, I might even marry him.
Love it. Oh, wow. All right, guys. Well, look, we're going to have to leave it there for the day, but thank you very much for your contributions this morning and to our listeners for tuning in, and we'll be back again next Friday to do it all over again, just like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, indeed.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Steph. Thanks, listeners.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.